It's essential that we should relearn frankly to face the fact that freedom can be had only at a price, and that as individuals we must be prepared to make severe material sacrifices to preserve our liberty. If we want to retain this, we must regain the conviction on which the rule of liberty in the Anglo-Saxon countries has been based, and which Benjamin Franklin expressed in a phrase applicable to us in our lives as individuals no less than as nations. Those who would give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety. Chapter 10. Why the Worst Get on Top. Power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Lord Acton. We must now examine a belief from which many who regard the advent of totalitarianism as inevitable derive consolation, and which seriously weakens the resistance of many others who would oppose it with all their might if they fully apprehended its nature. It is the belief that the most repellent features of the totalitarian regimes are due to the historical accident that they were established by groups of blackguards and thugs. Surely, it is argued, if in Germany the creation of a totalitarian regime brought the Streichers and Killingers, the Lies and Heines, the Himmlers and Heydrichs to power, this may prove the viciousness of the German character, but not that the rise of such people is the necessary consequence of a totalitarian system. Why should it not be possible that the same sort of system, if it be necessary to achieve important ends, be run by decent people for the good of the community as a whole? We must not deceive ourselves into believing that all good people must be Democrats or will necessarily wish to have a share in the government. Many, no doubt, would rather entrust it to somebody whom they think more competent. Although this might be unwise, there is nothing bad or dishonorable in approving a dictatorship of the good. Totalitarianism, we can already hear it argued, is a powerful system alike for good and evil, and the purpose for which it will be used depends entirely on the dictators. And those who think that it is not the system which we need fear, but the danger that it might be run by bad men, might even be tempted to forestall this danger by seeing that it is established in time by good men. No doubt an American or English fascist system would greatly differ from the Italian or German models. No doubt, if the transition were effected without violence, we might expect to get a better type of leader. And, if I had to live under a fascist system, I have no doubt that I would rather live under one run by Englishmen or Americans than under one run by anybody else. Yet all this does not mean that, judged on our present standards, our fascist system would, in the end, prove so very different or much less intolerable than its prototypes. There are strong reasons for believing that what to us appear the worst features of the existing totalitarian systems are not accidental byproducts, but phenomena which totalitarianism is certain, sooner or later, to produce. Just as the democratic statesman who sets out to plan economic life will soon be confronted with the alternative of either assuming dictatorial powers or abandoning his plans, so the totalitarian dictator would soon have to choose between disregard of ordinary morals and failure. It is for this reason that the unscrupulous and uninhibited are likely to be more successful in a society tending toward totalitarianism. Who does not see this has not yet grasped the full width of the gulf which separates totalitarianism from a liberal regime, the utter difference between the whole moral atmosphere under collectivism and the essentially individualist Western civilization. The moral basis of collectivism has, of course, been much debated in the past, but what concerns us here is not its moral basis, but its moral results. The usual discussions of the ethical aspects of collectivism refer to the question whether collectivism is demanded by existing moral convictions, or what moral convictions would be required if collectivism is to produce the hoped-for results. Our question, however, is what moral views will be produced by a collectivist organization of society, or what views are likely to rule it. The interaction between morals and institutions may well have the effect that the ethics produced by collectivism will be altogether different from the moral ideals that lead to the demand for collectivism. While we are likely to think that, since the desire for a collectivist system springs from high moral motives, such a system must be the breeding ground for the highest virtues, there is, in fact, no reason why any system should necessarily enhance those attitudes which serve the purpose for which it was designed. The ruling moral views will depend partly on the qualities that will lead individuals to success in a collectivist or totalitarian system, and partly on the requirements of the totalitarian machinery. We must here return for a moment to the position which precedes the suppression of democratic institutions and the creation of a totalitarian regime. In this stage, it is the general demand for quick and determined government action that is the dominating element in the situation. Dissatisfaction with the slow and cumbersome course of democratic procedure, which makes action for action's sake the goal. It is then the man or the party who seems strong and resolute enough to get things done, who exercises the greatest appeal. Strong, in this sense, means not merely a numerical majority. It is the ineffectiveness of parliamentary majorities with which people are dissatisfied. What they will seek is somebody with such solid support as to inspire confidence that he can carry out whatever he wants. It is here that the new type of party, organized on military lines, comes in. In the Central European countries, the socialist parties had familiarized the masses with political organizations of a semi-military character designed to absorb as much as possible of the private life of the members. All that was wanted to give one group overwhelming power was to carry the same principles somewhat further, to seek strength not in the assured votes of huge numbers at occasional elections, but in the absolute and unreserved support of a smaller but more thoroughly organized body. The chance of imposing a totalitarian regime on a whole people depends on the leader's first collecting round him a group which is prepared voluntarily to submit to that totalitarian discipline which they are to impose by force upon the rest. Although the socialist parties had the strength to get anything, if they had cared to use force, they were reluctant to do so. They had, without knowing it, set themselves a task which only the ruthless, ready to disregard the barriers of accepted morals, can execute. That socialism can be put into practice only by methods which most socialists disapprove is, of course, a lesson learned by many social reformers in the past. The old socialist parties were inhibited by their democratic ideals. They did not possess the ruthlessness required for the performance of their chosen task. It is characteristic that both in Germany and in Italy, the success of fascism was preceded by the refusal of the socialist parties to take over the responsibilities of government. They were unwilling wholeheartedly to employ the methods to which they had pointed the way. They still hoped for the miracle of a majority's agreeing on a particular plan for the organization of the whole of society. Others had already learned the lesson that, in a planned society, the question can no longer be on what do a majority of the people agree, but what the largest single group is whose members agree sufficiently to make unified direction of all affairs possible, or, if no such group large enough to enforce its views exists, how it can be created and who will succeed in creating it. There are three main reasons why such a numerous and strong group with fairly homogeneous views is not likely to be formed by the best, but rather by the worst elements of any society. By our standards, the principles on which such a group would be selected will be almost entirely negative. In the first instance, it is probably true that, in general, the higher the education and intelligence of individuals become, the more their views and tastes are differentiated, and the less likely they are to agree on a particular hierarchy of values. It is a corollary of this that, if we wish to find a high degree of uniformity and similarity of outlook, we have to descend to the regions of lower moral and intellectual standards, where the more primitive and common instincts and tastes prevail. This does not mean that the majority of people have low moral standards. It merely means that the largest group of people whose values are very similar are the people with low standards. It is, as it were, the lowest common denominator which unites the largest number of people. If a numerous group is needed, strong enough to impose their views on the values of life, on all the rest, it will never be those with highly differentiated and developed tastes. It will be those who form the mass, in the derogatory sense of the term, the least original and independent, who will be able to put the weight of their numbers behind their particular ideals. If, however, a potential dictator had to rely entirely on those whose uncomplicated and primitive instincts happen to be very similar, their number would scarcely give sufficient weight to their endeavors. He will have to increase their numbers by converting more to the same simple creed. Here comes in the second negative principle of selection. He will be able to obtain the support of all the docile and gullible, who have no strong convictions of their own, but are prepared to accept a ready-made system of values, if it is only drummed into their ears sufficiently loudly and frequently. It will be those whose vague and imperfectly formed ideas are easily swayed, and whose passions and emotions are readily aroused, who will thus swell the ranks of the totalitarian party. It is in connection with the deliberate effort of the skillful demagogue to weld together a closely coherent and homogeneous body of supporters that the third and perhaps most important negative element of selection enters. It seems to be almost a law of human nature that it is easier for people to agree on a negative program, on the hatred of an enemy, on the envy of those better off, than on any positive task. The contrast between the we and the they, the common fight against those outside the group, seems to be an essential ingredient in any creed which will solidly knit together a group for a common action. It is consequently always employed by those who seek not merely support of a policy, but the unreserved allegiance of huge masses. From their point of view, it has the great advantage of leaving them greater freedom of action than almost any positive program. The enemy, whether he be internal, like the Jew or the kulak, or external, seems to be an indispensable requisite in the armory of a totalitarian leader. That in Germany it was the Jew who became the enemy, until his place was taken by the plutocracies, was no less a result of the anti-capitalist resentment on which the whole movement was based than the selection of the kulak in Russia. In Germany and Austria, the Jew had come to be regarded as the representative of capitalism, because a traditional dislike of large classes of the population for commercial pursuits had left these more readily accessible to a group that was practically excluded from the more highly esteemed occupations. It is the old story of the alien races being admitted only to the less respected trades, and then being hated still more for practicing them. The fact that German anti-Semitism and anti-capitalism spring from the same root is of great importance for the understanding of what has happened there, but this is rarely grasped by foreign observers. To treat the universal tendency of collectivist policy to become nationalistic as due entirely to the necessity for securing unhesitating support would be to neglect another and no less important factor. It may indeed be questioned whether anyone can realistically conceive of a collectivist program other than in the service of a limited group, whether collectivism can exist in any form other than that of some kind of particularism, be it nationalism, racialism, or classism. The belief in the community of aims and interests with fellow men seems to presuppose a greater degree of similarity of outlook and thought than exists between men merely as human beings. If the other members of one's group cannot all be personally known, they must at least be of the same kind as those around us, think and talk in the same way, and about the same kind of things, in order that we may identify ourselves with them. Collectivism on a world scale seems to be unthinkable, except in the service of a small ruling elite. It would certainly raise not only technical, but above all, moral problems, which none of our socialists is willing to face. If the English proletarian, for instance, is entitled to an equal share of the income now derived from his country's capital resources, and of the control of their use, because they are the result of exploitation, so on the same principle, all the Indians would be entitled not only to the income from, but also to the use of, a proportional share of the British capital. But what socialists seriously contemplate the equal division of existing capital resources among the people of the world? They all regard the capital as belonging not to humanity, but to the nation. Though even within the nation, few would dare to advocate that the richer regions should be deprived of some of their capital equipment in order to help the poorer regions. What socialists proclaim as a duty toward the fellow members of the existing states, they are not prepared to grant to the foreigner. From a consistent collectivist point of view, the claims of the have-not nations for a new division of the world are entirely justified, though, if consistently applied, those who demand it most loudly would lose by it almost as much as the richest nations. They are, therefore, careful not to base their claims on any equalitarian principles, but on their pretended superior capacity to organize other peoples. One of the inherent contradictions of the collectivist philosophy is that, while basing itself on the humanistic morals which individualism has developed, it is practicable only within a relatively small group. That socialism, so long as it remains theoretical, is internationalist, while as soon as it is put into practice, whether in Russia or in Germany, it becomes violently nationalist, is one of the reasons why liberal socialism, as most people in the Western world imagine it, is purely theoretical, while the practice of socialism is everywhere totalitarian. Compare now the instructive discussion in Franz Burkenau, Socialism, National or International, 1942. Collectivism has no room for the wide humanitarianism of liberalism, but only for the narrow particularism of the totalitarian. If the community or the state are prior to the individual, if they have ends of their own, independent of and superior to those of the individuals, only those individuals who work for the same ends can be regarded as members of the community. It is a necessary consequence of this view that a person is respected only as a member of the group, that is, only if and in so far as he works for the recognized common ends, and that he derives his whole dignity only from this membership, and not merely from being man. Indeed, the very concepts of humanity, and therefore of any form of internationalism, are entirely products of the individualist view of man, and there can be no place for them in a collectivist system of thought. It is entirely in the spirit of collectivism when Nietzsche makes his Zarathustra say, "A thousand goals have existed hitherto, for a thousand people existed, but the fetter for the thousand necks is still lacking. The one goal is still lacking. Humanity has no goal yet. But tell me, I pray, my brethren, if the goal be lacking to humanity, is not humanity itself lacking?" Apart from the basic fact that the community of collectivism can extend only as far as the unity of purpose of the individuals exists or can be created, several contributory factors strengthen the tendency of collectivism to become particularist and exclusive. Of these, one of the most important is that the desire of the individual to identify himself with a group is very frequently the result of a feeling of inferiority, and that, therefore, his want will be satisfied only if membership of the group confers some superiority over outsiders. Sometimes, it seems, the very fact that these violent instincts, which the individual knows he must curb within the group, can be given a free range in the collective action toward the outsider, becomes a further inducement for merging personality in that of the group. There is a profound truth expressed in the title of Reinhold Niebuhr's Moral Man and Immoral Society, however little we can follow him in the conclusions he draws from his thesis. There is, indeed, as he says elsewhere, an increasing tendency among modern men to imagine themselves ethical because they have delegated their vices to larger and larger groups. Quoted from an article of Dr. Niebuhr's by E. H. Carr, The 20 Years Crisis, 1941, page 203. To act on behalf of a group seems to free people of many of the moral restraints which control their behavior as individuals within the group. The definitely antagonistic attitude which most planners take toward internationalism is further explained by the fact that in the existing world all outside contacts of a group are obstacles to their effectively planning the sphere in which they can attempt it. It is therefore no accident that, as the editor of one of the most comprehensive collective studies on planning has discovered to his chagrin, most planners are militant nationalists. Findlay McKenzie, editor, Planned Society, Yesterday, Today, Tomorrow, A Symposium, 1937, page XX. The nationalist and imperialist propensities of socialist planners much more common than is generally recognized, are not always as flagrant as, for example, in the case of the Webbs and some of the other early Fabians, with whom enthusiasm for planning was characteristically combined with the veneration for the large and powerful political units and a contempt for the small state. The historian Elie Halévy, speaking of the Webbs when he first knew them 40 years ago, records that their socialism was profoundly anti-liberal. They did not hate the Tories. Indeed, they were extraordinarily lenient to them. But they had no mercy for Gladstonian liberalism. It was the time of the Boer War, and both the advanced liberals and the men who were beginning to form the Labour Party had generously sided with the Boers against British imperialism, in the name of freedom and humanity. But the two Webbs and their friend, Bernard Shaw, stood apart. They were ostentatiously imperialistic. The independence of small nations might mean something to the liberal individualist. It meant nothing to collectivists like themselves. I can still hear Sidney Webb explaining to me that the future belonged to the great administrative nations, where the officials govern and the police keep order. And elsewhere, Halévy quotes George Bernard Shaw, arguing about the same time that the world is to the big and powerful states by necessity, and the little ones must come within their border or be crushed out of existence. Elie Halévy, L'Air des Tyrannies, Paris, 1938, page 217, and History of the English People, Epilogue, 1, 105-106. I have quoted at length these passages, which would not surprise one in a description of the German ancestors of National Socialism, because they provide so characteristic an example of that glorification of power which easily leads from socialism to nationalism, and which profoundly affects the ethical views of all collectivists. So far as the rights of small nations are concerned, Marx and Engels were little better than most other consistent collectivists, and the views occasionally expressed about Czechs or Poles resemble those of contemporary National Socialists. Compare Karl Marx, Revolution and Counter-Revolution, and Engels' Letter to Marx, May 23, 1851. While to the great individualist social philosophers of the 19th century, to a Lord Acton or a Jakob Burckhardt, down to contemporary socialists like Bertrand Russell, who have inherited the liberal tradition, power itself has always appeared the arch-evil. To the strict collectivist, it is a goal in itself. It is not only, as Russell has so well described, that the desire to organize social life according to a unitary plan itself springs largely from a desire for power. Bertrand Russell, The Scientific Outlook, 1931, page 211. It is even more the outcome of the fact that, in order to achieve their end, collectivists must create power, power over men wielded by other men, of a magnitude never before known, and that their success will depend on the extent to which they achieve such power. This remains true even though many liberal socialists are guided in their endeavors by the tragic illusion that by depriving private individuals of the power they possess in an individualist system, and by transferring this power to society, they can thereby extinguish power. What all those who argue in this manner overlook is that, by concentrating power so that it can be used in the service of a single plan, it is not merely transferred, but infinitely heightened. That by uniting in the hands of some single body, power formerly exercised independently by many, an amount of power is created infinitely greater than any that existed before, so much more far-reaching as almost to be different in kind. It is entirely fallacious when it is sometimes argued that the great power exercised by a central planning board would be no greater than the power collectively exercised by private boards of directors. B. E. Lippincott, in his introduction to Oscar Lange and F. M. Taylor, On the Economic Theory of Socialism, Minneapolis, 1938, page 35. There is, in a competitive society, nobody who can exercise even a fraction of the power which a socialist planning board would possess, and if nobody can consciously use the power, it is just an abuse of words to assert that it rests with all the capitalists put together. We must not allow ourselves to be deceived by the fact that the word power, apart from the sense in which it is used with respect to human beings, is also used in an impersonal, or rather anthropomorphic, sense for any determining cause. Of course, there will always be something that determines everything that happens, and in this sense, the amount of power existing must always be the same. But this is not true of the power consciously wielded by human beings. It is merely a play upon words to speak of the power collectively exercised by private boards of directors, so long as they do not combine to concerted action, which would, of course, mean the end of competition and the creation of a planned economy. To split or decentralize power is necessarily to reduce the absolute amount of power, and the competitive system is the only system designed to minimize by decentralization the power exercised by man over man. We have seen before how the separation of economic and political aims is an essential guarantee of individual freedom, and how it is consequently attacked by all collectivists. To this, we must now add that the substitution of political for economic power, now so often demanded, means necessarily the substitution of power from which there is no escape for a power which is always limited. What is called economic power, while it can be an instrument of coercion, is, in the hands of private individuals, never exclusive or complete power, never power over the whole life of a person. But centralized as an instrument of political power, it creates a degree of dependence scarcely distinguishable from slavery. From the two central features of every collectivist system, the need for a commonly accepted system of ends of the group, and the all-overriding desire to give to the group the maximum of power to achieve these ends, grows a definite system of morals, which on some points coincides and on others violently contrasts with ours, but differs from it in one point which makes it doubtful whether we can call it morals, that it does not leave the individual conscience free to apply its own rules, and does not even know any general rules which the individual is required or allowed to observe in all circumstances. This makes collectivist morals so different from what we have known as morals that we find it difficult to discover any principle in them, which they nevertheless possess. The difference of principle is very much the same as that which we have already considered in connection with the rule of law. Like formal law, the rules of individualist ethics, however unprecise they may be in many respects, are general and absolute. They prescribe or prohibit a general type of action irrespective of whether, in the particular instance, the ultimate purpose is good or bad. To cheat or steal, to torture or betray a confidence, is held to be bad, irrespective of whether or not, in the particular instance, any harm follows from it. Neither the fact that in a given instance nobody may be the worse for it, nor any high purpose for which such an act may have been committed, can alter the fact that it is bad. Though we may sometimes be forced to choose between different evils, they remain evils. The principle that the end justifies the means is, in individualist ethics, regarded as the denial of all morals. In collectivist ethics, it becomes necessarily the supreme rule. There is literally nothing which the consistent collectivist must not be prepared to do if it serves the good of the whole, because the good of the whole is to him the only criterion of what ought to be done. The raison d'etat in which collectivist ethics has found its most explicit formulation knows no other limit than that set by expediency, the suitability of the particular act for the end in view. And what the raison d'etat affirms with respect to the relations between different countries applies equally to the relations between different individuals within the collectivist state. There can be no limit to what its citizen must be prepared to do, no act which his conscience must prevent him from committing, if it is necessary for an end which the community has set itself, or which his superiors order him to achieve. The absence of absolute formal rules in collectivist ethics does not, of course, mean that there are not some useful habits of the individuals which a collectivist community will encourage, and others which it will discourage. Quite the reverse. It will take a much greater interest in the individual's habits of life than an individualist community. To be a useful member of a collectivist society requires very definite qualities which must be strengthened by constant practice. The reason why we designate these qualities as useful habits, and can hardly describe them as moral virtues, is that the individual could never be allowed to put these rules above any definite orders, or to let them become an obstacle to the achievement of any of the particular aims of his community. They only serve, as it were, to fill any gaps which direct orders or the designation of particular aims may leave, but they can never justify a conflict with the will of the authority. The differences between the virtues which will continue to be esteemed under a collectivist system and those which will disappear is well illustrated by a comparison of the virtues which even their worst enemies admit the Germans, or rather the typical Prussian, to possess, and those of which they are commonly thought lacking, and in which the English people, with some justification, used to pride themselves as excelling. Few people will deny that the Germans on the whole are industrious and disciplined, thorough and energetic. To the degree of ruthlessness, conscientious and single-minded in any tasks they undertake, that they possess a strong sense of order, duty, and strict obedience to authority, and that they often show great readiness to make personal sacrifices and great courage in physical danger. All these make the German an efficient instrument in carrying out an assigned task, and they have accordingly been carefully nurtured in the old Prussian state and the new Prussian-dominated Reich. What the typical German is often thought to lack are the individualist virtues of tolerance and respect for other individuals and their opinions, of independence of mind, and that uprightness of character and readiness to defend one's own convictions against a superior, which the Germans themselves, usually conscious that they lack it, call Zivilcourage, of consideration for the weak and infirm, and of that healthy contempt and dislike of power which only an old tradition of personal liberty creates. Deficient, they seem also, in most of those little yet so important qualities which facilitate the intercourse between men in a free society, kindliness and a sense of humor, personal modesty, and respect for the privacy and belief in the good intentions of one's neighbor. After what we have already said, it will not cause surprise that these individualist virtues are at the same time eminently social virtues, virtues which smooth social contacts and make control from above less necessary and at the same time more difficult. They are virtues which flourish wherever the individualist or commercial type of society has prevailed, and which are missing according as the collectivist or military type of society predominates, a difference which is, or was, as noticeable between the various regions of Germany as it has now become of the views which rule in Germany and those characteristic of the West. Until recently, at least, in those parts of Germany which have been longest exposed to the civilizing forces of commerce, the old commercial towns of the South and West, and the Hanse towns, the general moral concepts were probably much more akin to those of the Western people than to those which have now become dominant all over Germany. It would, however, be highly unjust to regard the masses of the totalitarian people as devoid of moral fervor because they give unstinted support to a system which, to us, seems a denial of most moral values. For the great majority of them, the opposite is probably true. The intensity of the moral emotions behind a movement like that of National Socialism or Communism can probably be compared only to those of the great religious movements of history. Once you admit that the individual is merely a means to serve the ends of the higher entity called society or the nation, most of those features of totalitarian regimes which horrify us follow of necessity. From the collectivist standpoint, intolerance and brutal suppression of dissent, the complete disregard of the life and happiness of the individual, are essential and unavoidable consequences of this basic premise. And the collectivist can admit this, and at the same time claim that his system is superior to one in which the selfish interests of the individual are allowed to obstruct the full realization of the ends the community pursues. When German philosophers again and again represent the striving for personal happiness as itself immoral, and only the fulfillment of an imposed duty as praiseworthy, they are perfectly sincere, however difficult this may be to understand for those who have been brought up in a different tradition. Where there is one common, all-overriding end, there is no room for any general morals or rules. To a limited extent, we ourselves experience this in wartime. But even war, and the greatest peril, had led in the democratic countries only to a very moderate approach to totalitarianism, very little setting aside of all other values in the service of a single purpose. But where a few specific ends dominate the whole of society, it is inevitable that occasionally cruelty may become a duty, that acts which revolt all our feeling, such as the shooting of hostages or the killing of the old or sick, should be treated as mere matters of expediency, that the compulsory uprooting and transportation of hundreds of thousands should become an instrument of policy approved by almost everybody except the victims, or that suggestions like that of a conscription of women for breeding purposes can be seriously contemplated. There is always, in the eyes of the collectivist, a greater goal which these acts serve, and which, to him, justifies them, because the pursuit of the common end of society can know no limits in any rights or values of any individual. But while for the mass of the citizens of the totalitarian state, it is often unselfish devotion to an ideal, although one that is repellent to us, which makes them approve and even perform such deeds, this cannot be pleaded for those who guide its policy. To be a useful assistant in the running of a totalitarian state, it is not enough that a man should be prepared to accept specious justification of vile deeds. He must himself be prepared actively to break every moral rule he has ever known, if this seems necessary to achieve the end set for him. Since it is the supreme leader who alone determines the ends, his instruments must have no moral convictions of their own. They must, above all, be unreservedly committed to the person of the leader. But next to this, the most important thing is that they should be completely unprincipled and literally capable of everything. They must have no ideals of their own which they want to realize, no ideas about right or wrong which might interfere with the intentions of the leader. There is thus, in the positions of power, little to attract those who hold moral beliefs of the kind which, in the past, have guided the European peoples, little which could compensate for the distastefulness of many of the particular tasks, and little opportunity to gratify any more idealistic desires, to recompense for the undeniable risk the sacrifice of most of the pleasures of private life and of personal independence which the posts of great responsibility involve. The only tastes which are satisfied are the taste for power as such and the pleasure of being obeyed and of being part of a well-functioning and immensely powerful machine to which everything else must give way. Yet while there is little that is likely to induce men who are good by our standards to aspire to leading positions in the totalitarian machine, and much to deter them, there will be special opportunities for the ruthless and unscrupulous. There will be jobs to be done about the badness of which, taken by themselves, nobody has any doubt, but which have to be done in the service of some higher end, and which have to be executed with the same expertness and efficiency as any others. And as there will be need for actions which are bad in themselves, and which all those still influenced by traditional morals will be reluctant to perform, the readiness to do bad things becomes a path to promotion and power. The positions in a totalitarian society in which it is necessary to practice cruelty and intimidation, deliberate deception and spying, are numerous. Neither the Gestapo, nor the administration of a concentration camp, neither the Ministry of Propaganda, nor the SA or SS, or their Italian or Russian counterparts, are suitable places for the exercise of humanitarian feelings. Yet it is through positions like these that the road to the highest positions in the totalitarian state leads. It is only too true when a distinguished American economist concludes from a similar brief enumeration of the duties of the authorities of a collectivist state that they would have to do these things whether they wanted to or not, and the probability of the people in power being individuals who would dislike the possession and exercise of power is on a level with the probability that an extremely tender-hearted person would get the job of whipping master in a slave plantation. Professor Frank H. Knight, in The Journal of Political Economy, December 1938, page 869. We cannot, however, exhaust this subject here. The problem of the selection of the leaders is closely bound up with the wide problem of selection according to the opinions held, or rather, according to the readiness with which a person conforms to an ever-changing set of doctrines. And this leads us to one of the most characteristic moral features of totalitarianism, its relation to and its effect on all the virtues falling under the general heading of truthfulness. This is so big a subject that it requires a separate chapter. Chapter 11. The End of Truth. It is significant that the nationalization of thought has proceeded everywhere, pari passu, with the nationalization of industry, E. H. Carr. The most effective way of making everybody serve the single system of ends toward which the social plan is directed is to make everybody believe in those ends. To make a totalitarian system function efficiently, it is not enough that everybody should be forced to work for the same ends. It is essential that the people should come to regard them as their own ends. Although the beliefs must be chosen for the people and imposed upon them, they must become their beliefs, a generally accepted creed, which makes the individuals, as far as possible, act spontaneously in the way the planner wants. If the feeling of oppression in totalitarian countries is, in general, much less acute than most people in liberal countries imagine, this is because the totalitarian governments succeed to a high degree in making people think as they want them to. This is, of course, brought about by the various forms of propaganda. Its technique is now so familiar that we need say little about it. The only point that needs to be stressed is that neither propaganda in itself nor the techniques employed are peculiar to totalitarianism, and that what so completely changes its nature and effect in a totalitarian state is that all propaganda serves the same goal, that all the instruments of propaganda are coordinated to influence the individuals in the same direction, and to produce the characteristic Gleichschaltung of all minds. As a result, the effect of propaganda in totalitarian countries is different not only in magnitude, but in kind, from that of the propaganda made for different ends by independent and competing agencies. If all the sources of current information are effectively under one single control, it is no longer a question of merely persuading the people of this or that. The skillful propagandist then has power to mold their minds in any direction he chooses, and even the most intelligent and independent people cannot entirely escape that influence if they are long isolated from all other sources of information. While in the totalitarian states this status of propaganda gives it a unique power over the minds of the people, the peculiar moral effects arise not from the technique, but from the object and scope of totalitarian propaganda. If it could be confined to indoctrinating the people with the whole system of values toward which the social effort is directed, propaganda would represent merely a particular manifestation of the characteristic features of collectivist morals, which we have already considered. If its object were merely to teach the people a definite and comprehensive moral code, the problem would be solely whether this moral code is good or bad. We have seen that the moral code of a totalitarian society is not likely to appeal to us, that even the striving for equality by means of a directed economy can result only in an officially enforced inequality, an authoritarian determination of the status of each individual in the new hierarchical order, and that most of the humanitarian elements of our morals, the respect for human life, for the weak, and for the individual generally, will disappear. However repellent this may be to most people, and though it involves a change in moral standards, it is not necessarily entirely anti-moral. Some features of such a system may even appeal to the sternest moralists of a conservative tint, and seem to them preferable to the softer standards of a liberal society. The moral consequences of totalitarian propaganda which we must now consider are, however, of an even more profound kind. They are destructive of all morals, because they undermine one of the foundations of all morals, the sense of and the respect for truth. From the nature of its task, totalitarian propaganda cannot confine itself to values, to questions of opinion and moral convictions, in which the individual always will conform more or less to the views ruling his community, but must extend to questions of fact, where human intelligence is involved in a different way. This is so, first, because in order to induce people to accept the official values, these must be justified or shown to be connected with the values already held by the people, which usually will involve assertions about causal connections between means and ends. And, second, because the distinction between ends and means, between the goal aimed at and the measures taken to achieve it, is in fact never so clear-cut and definite as any general discussion of these problems is likely to suggest, and because, therefore, people must be brought to agree not only with the ultimate aims, but also with the views about the facts and possibilities on which the particular measures are based. We have seen that agreement on that complete ethical code, that all-comprehensive system of values which is implicit in an economic plan, does not exist in a free society, but would have to be created. But we must not assume that the planner will approach his task aware of that need, or that, even if he were aware of it, it would be possible to create such a comprehensive code in advance. He only finds out about the conflicts between different needs as he goes along, and he has to make his decisions as the necessity arises. The code of values guiding his decisions does not exist in abstracto, before the decisions have to be made. It has to be created with the particular decisions. We have also seen how this inability to separate the general problem of values from the particular decisions makes it impossible that a democratic body, while unable to decide the technical details of a plan, should yet determine the values guiding it. And while the planning authority will constantly have to decide issues on merits about which there exist no definite moral rules, it will have to justify its decisions to the people, or at least have somehow to make the people believe that they are the right decisions. Although those responsible for a decision may have been guided by no more than prejudice, some guiding principle will have to be stated publicly if the community is not merely passively to submit, but actively to support the measure. The need to rationalize the likes and dislikes, which, for lack of anything else, must guide the planner in many of his decisions, and the necessity of stating his reasons in a form in which they will appeal to as many people as possible, will force him to construct theories, i.e., assertions about the connections between facts, which then become an integral part of the governing doctrine. This process of creating a myth to justify his action need not be conscious. The totalitarian leader may be guided merely by an instinctive dislike of the state of things he has found, and a desire to create a new hierarchical order which conforms better to his conception of merit. He may merely know that he dislikes the Jews who seemed to be so successful in an order which did not provide a satisfactory place for him, and that he loves and admires the tall blonde man, the aristocratic figure of the novels of his youth. So he will readily embrace theories which seem to provide a rational justification for the prejudices which he shares with many of his fellows. Thus, a pseudo-scientific theory becomes part of the official creed which, to a greater or lesser degree, directs everybody's action. Or the widespread dislike of the industrial civilization and a romantic yearning for country life, together with a probably erroneous idea about the special value of country people as soldiers, provide the basis for another myth, Blut und Boden, blood and soil, expressing not merely ultimate values, but a whole host of beliefs about cause and effect which, once they have become ideals directing the activity of the whole community, must not be questioned. The need for such official doctrines as an instrument of directing and rallying the efforts of the people has been clearly foreseen by the various theoreticians of the totalitarian system. Plato's Noble Lies and Sorel's Myths serve the same purpose as the racial doctrine of the Nazis or the theory of the corporative state of Mussolini. They are all necessarily based on particular views about facts, which are then elaborated into scientific theories in order to justify a preconceived opinion. The most effective way of making people accept the validity of the values they are to serve is to persuade them that they are really the same as those which they, or at least the best among them, have always held, but which were not properly understood or recognized before. The people are made to transfer their allegiance from the old gods to the new, under the pretense that the new gods really are what their sound instinct had always told them, but what, before, they had only dimly seen. And the most efficient technique to this end is to use the old words but change their meaning. Few traits of totalitarian regimes are at the same time so confusing to the superficial observer and yet so characteristic of the whole intellectual climate as the complete perversion of language, the change of meaning of the words by which the ideals of the new regimes are expressed. The worst sufferer in this respect is, of course, the word liberty. It is a word used as freely in totalitarian states as elsewhere. Indeed, it could almost be said, and it should serve as a warning to us to be on our guard against all the tempters who promise us new liberties for old. This is the main title of a recent work by the historian Carl L. Becker. That wherever liberty, as we understand it, has been destroyed, this has almost always been done in the name of some new freedom promised to the people. Even among us, we have planners for freedom who promise us a collective freedom for the group, the nature of which may be gathered from the fact that its advocate finds it necessary to assure us that naturally the advent of planned freedom does not mean that all, earlier forms of freedom must be abolished. Dr. Karl Mannheim, from whose work, Man and Society in an Age of Reconstruction, page 377, these sentences are taken, at least warns us that a conception of freedom modeled on the preceding age is an obstacle to any real understanding of the problem. But his use of the word freedom is as misleading as it is in the mouth of totalitarian politicians. Like their freedom, the collective freedom he offers us is not the freedom of the members of society, but the unlimited freedom of the planner to do with society what he pleases. Peter Drucker, The End of Economic Man, page 74, correctly observes that the less freedom there is, the more there is talk of the new freedom. Yet this new freedom is a mere word which covers the exact contradiction of all that Europe ever understood by freedom. The new freedom which is preached in Europe is, however, the right of the majority against the individual. It is the confusion of freedom with power carried to the extreme. In this particular case, the perversion of the meaning of the word has, of course, been well prepared by a long line of German philosophers and, not least, by many of the theoreticians of socialism. But freedom or liberty are by no means the only words whose meaning has been changed into their opposites to make them serve as instruments of totalitarian propaganda. We have already seen how the same happens to justice and law, right and equality. The list could be extended until it includes almost all moral and political terms in general use. If one has not one's self experienced this process, it is difficult to appreciate the magnitude of this change of the meaning of words, the confusion which it creates, and the barriers to any rational discussion which it creates. It has to be seen to be understood how, if one of two brothers embraces the new faith, after a short while, he appears to speak a different language, which makes any real communication between them impossible. And the confusion becomes worse because this change of meaning of the words describing political ideals is not a single event, but a continuous process, a technique employed consciously or unconsciously to direct the people. Gradually, as this process continues, the whole language becomes despoiled, and words become empty shells deprived of any definite meaning, as capable of denoting one thing as its opposite, and used solely for the emotional associations which still adhere to them. It is not difficult to deprive the great majority of independent thought, but the minority who will retain an inclination to criticize must also be silenced. We have already seen why coercion cannot be confined to the acceptance of the ethical code underlying the plan according to which all social activity is directed. Since many parts of this code will never be explicitly stated, since many parts of the guiding scale of values will exist only implicitly in the plan itself, in every detail, in fact, every act of the government, must become sacrosanct and exempt from criticism. If the people are to support the common effort without hesitation, they must be convinced that not only the end aimed at, but also the means chosen, are the right ones. The official creed, to which adherence must be enforced, will therefore comprise all the views about facts on which the plan is based. Public criticism or even expressions of doubt must be suppressed because they tend to weaken public support. As the Web's report of the position in every Russian enterprise, whilst the work is in progress, any public expression of doubt or even fear that the plan will not be successful is an act of disloyalty and even of treachery because of its possible effects on the will and on the efforts of the rest of the staff. Sidney and Beatrice Webb, Soviet Communism, page 1038. When the doubt or fear expressed concerns not the success of a particular enterprise, but of the whole social plan, it must be treated even more as sabotage. Facts and theories must thus become no less the object of an official doctrine than views about values, and the whole apparatus for spreading knowledge, the schools and the press, radio and motion picture, will be used exclusively to spread those views which, whether true or false, will strengthen the belief in the rightness of the decisions taken by the authority, and all information that might cause doubt or hesitation will be withheld. The probable effect on the people's loyalty to the system becomes the only criterion for deciding whether a particular piece of information is to be published or suppressed. The situation in a totalitarian state is permanently, and in all fields, the same that it is elsewhere in some fields in wartime. Everything which might cause doubt about the wisdom of the government or create discontent will be kept from the people. The basis of unfavorable comparisons with conditions elsewhere, the knowledge of possible alternatives to the course actually taken, information which might suggest failure on the part of the government to live up to its promises or to take advantage of opportunities to improve conditions, all will be suppressed. There is consequently no field where the systematic control of information will not be practiced and uniformity of views not enforced. This applies even to fields apparently most remote from any political interests, and particularly to all the sciences, even the most abstract. That in the disciplines dealing directly with human affairs, and therefore most immediately affecting political views, such as history, law, or economics, the disinterested search for truth cannot be allowed in a totalitarian system, and the vindication of the official views becomes the sole object, is easily seen and has been amply confirmed by experience. These disciplines have, indeed, in all totalitarian countries, become the most fertile factories of the official myths, which the rulers use to guide the minds and wills of their subjects. It is not surprising that in these spheres even the pretense that they search for truth is abandoned, and that the authorities decide what doctrines ought to be taught and published. Totalitarian control of opinion extends, however, also to subjects which at first seem to have no political significance. Sometimes it is difficult to explain why particular doctrines should be officially proscribed, or why others should be encouraged, and it is curious that these likes and dislikes are apparently somewhat similar in the different totalitarian systems. In particular, they all seem to have in common an intense dislike of the more abstract forms of thought, a dislike characteristically also shown by many of the collectivists among our scientists. Whether the theory of relativity is represented as a Semitic attack on the foundation of Christian and Nordic physics, or opposed because it is in conflict with dialectical materialism and Marxist dogma, comes very much to the same thing. Nor does it make much difference whether certain theorems of mathematical statistics are attacked because they form part of the class struggle on the ideological frontier and are a product of the historical role of mathematics as the servant of the bourgeoisie, or whether the whole subject is condemned because it provides no guarantee that it will serve the interest of the people. It seems that pure mathematics is no less a victim, and that even the holding of particular views about the nature of continuity can be ascribed to bourgeois prejudices. According to the Webs, the Journal for Marxist-Leninist Natural Sciences has the following slogans. We stand for party in mathematics. We stand for the purity of Marxist-Leninist theory in surgery. The situation seems to be very similar in Germany. The Journal of the National Socialist Association of Mathematicians is full of party in mathematics, and one of the best-known German physicists, the Nobel Prizeman Lennart, has summed up his life work under the title German Physics in 4 volumes. It is entirely in keeping with the whole spirit of totalitarianism that it condemns any human activity done for its own sake and without ulterior purpose. Science for science's sake, art for art's sake, are equally abhorrent to the Nazis, our socialist intellectuals, and the communists.